I was dispatched to our Walmart for somebody who was unwanted. I responded, arrived, made contact with this person, gave them multiple verbal commands to stop and to drop the hatchet. They refused to do that while they were walking towards me, and I ended up shooting. I suffered in silence. I wasn't reaching out. On my days off, I was consuming alcohol and just poor coping strategies. I'm still at a loss because all my life, all I've ever wanted to be was a police officer, as far back as I could remember. And then all of a sudden, I get walked out of the police department. If I can share my experience and help just one person, or help one person help somebody else, that's what it's all about.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Dr. Stacy Raymond. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Adam A. Myers, founder of Stop the Threat, Stop the Stigma, about mental health and resiliency in law enforcement. Catch all our episodes by liking and subscribing on YouTube or Respond to Resilience, Facebook, Respond to Wellness Inc., PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and go to our website, ResponderTV.com, to catch all the past episodes. We'll be back to speak with Adam right after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Lumley, LCSW EMTB. And we're really pleased to welcome Adam A. Myers to the show today to have, a really meaningful conversation. Just give you a little background on Adam. He was a police officer and detective in Wisconsin for 21 years, starting his law enforcement career in 2001. And prior to that, he was a five-year active duty United States Army military policeman. Adam was a field training officer and an instructor in firearms, professional communications, vehicle contacts, scenario, and officer wellness. Adam is a mental health advocate and takes every opportunity to speak about his personal and professional challenges with mental health after his 2016 on-duty deadly shooting. Adam is currently employed as an emergency mental health crisis worker in Wisconsin. And we'd like to welcome Adam to Respond to Resilience.
Thank you, David. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak about such an important topic and my experience.
So, Adam, I'd like to start off by asking you, can you tell us about how that incident in 2016 changed your career and your life?
Well, on April 8th, 2016, I was on duty as a patrol officer in Wisconsin. I began my shift at 11 a.m. and was scheduled to work until 7:30 p.m. I was actually working on a retail theft report at the police department when I was dispatched to our Walmart for somebody who was unwanted, and the chaperones with that person wanted assistance from the police with escorting them out of the store.
You could respond to Walmart. I have a worker from the Northern Center on 1021. She states that they are there with a client who's refusing to leave with them. They're currently inside the store following her. They state that she can get violent.
So I responded to Walmart. As I was responding, the call progressively became more emergent. This person was in the sporting goods section, continuing to refuse to leave the store and trying to arm themselves with a hatchet.
276.
She's by the sporting goods in the store. Caller believes she's opening a knife in that section. She's a white female, born in 90, 5'2", 346 pounds, wearing a tie-dye shirt and blue jeans.
Eventually, this person was able to remove a hatchet from the packaging and started walking around the store. and threatening customers.
He is in possession of a knife and is threatening people with it.
76 to Halley Units, I'll be responding through the auto center.
And I responded, arrived, made contact with this person, gave them multiple verbal commands to stop and to drop the hatchet. They refused to do that while they were walking towards me, and I ended up shooting them.
76 County, shots fired. Law enforcement, shots fired. Send EMS.
Command 4, sending EMS. Shots fired.
It sounds like every responder's worst nightmare is, especially a police officer, having to use deadly force. And how did you decide to start sharing that story and go public in terms of, you know, the challenges that it created in your mental health?
Almost immediately, I felt obligated to share my experience, some of the struggles that I was facing personally and professionally with my mental health. I just knew that I wasn't alone, and I was hoping that by sharing my experience that it would help just at least one person. And I began speaking in 2019.
What was the response from your chief, your colleagues, family, friends? Like, what? How did they respond to this?
I have to tell you, my chief was very supportive. And when I mean supportive, I knew that he was genuine. Was supporting me because I would hear him support me when I wasn't around. So that meant a lot to me. He wasn't just saying, I support you. If you need anything, let me know.
Right.
He almost immediately let the media know that he supported me. And that meant so much that I actually printed out his statement to the media, put it in a frame, and it was sitting on my desk up until May of this year. Because when you know that you're boss supports you, that means everything.
Right.
When you have a rough day and you know that your chief of police supports you and is there for you, not only for what you did, but for what you're going through, if you need to reach out, if you need help, that you can go to your supervision, that you can go to your chief and say, this is what I'm going through. I can't be here today. I need to go home. And they genuinely support you. That's very important. It meant a lot to me. My family, they supported me 100%, family, friends, and even complete strangers. When I went back to work, there were many people in the public that would come up to me and recognize me as the officer who was involved in the shooting. They'd ask to give me a hug. They gave me a hug. They said that they prayed for me. And I didn't even know these community members. So it was it was a good feeling to know that even complete strangers were supporting me, praying for me, and wanting me to be okay with what I had to do.
Right. Did you have a peer support team in place at that time?
We did not. We had an employee assistance program.
Okay.
So that was very helpful.
In terms of mental health, after this incident, can you talk a little bit about, you know, what you went through, you know, the challenges you faced, and then how did you find help, and what tools helped you to kind of recover from all these challenges you were going through?
Well, for many years, I suffered in silence. I coped poorly. I abused alcohol. And what I mean by abusing alcohol is, before my shooting, I would drink wine, have a glass of wine every now and then. But after my shooting, I stopped drinking wine. I went right to vodka and whiskey. And then I would combine things like sleeping medicine, cold and flu medicine, allergy medicine,
make my
own cocktail just to numb my feelings. And I have a thing of vodka right here. I would drink a thing of vodka like this, 30 minutes, it'd be gone. And then I would just pass out and sleep the day away. And there was one incident that I remember. My oldest daughter had prescription cold medicine, and it had codeine in it.
I poured
a glass of wine, looked in the medicine cabinet, and saw that she had a little bit of that medicine left, and I poured it in my wine and drank it away. So I just didn't care. I didn't care. I wanted to have that instant feel better. I wanted to numb what I was going through. And you know, for the first time in my life, I tried marijuana. I had always prided myself with never doing drugs.
Yeah.
And I just didn't care at the time. I wanted to feel better, and I wanted to feel better right away. So I drank and drove easily about a dozen times. Before I would go somewhere, I would stop by one of the local gas stations and buy two or three of these small little cinnamon whiskey bottles. Mm-hmm. And before I would start driving, I'd consume that in my car. And because I rationalized that it would take probably about 30 minutes for the alcohol to kick in, and by then I would be wherever I needed to be, which is ridiculous. I got very lucky that I didn't hurt myself or get involved in a crash or be arrested.
Right.
I got really lucky.
Adam, what were you numbing out? What was coming up for you that you had to numb out?
I was depressed. I was very depressed. Deep down, I know I did the right thing. I did what I had to do. You know, it's 6-7 years later, and I know I did the right thing. You wouldn't be able to convince me that I could have done something else. But I think that just the reality of taking somebody's life, pulling the trigger. When I pulled the trigger, I changed lives. Not only did I take a life, but I changed my life. I changed lives of people who were in the store, people I won't ever even know or hear their experience related to the shooting. But every single day, one way or another, I think about that day.
And I think you're going to be changing lives by sharing your story so openly and so honestly. So thank you so much for being willing to do that.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit more about maybe when you recognized you needed help and what kind of help did you seek, and then what tools helped you to regain your life back.
Well, for many years, like I said, I suffered in silence. I wasn't reaching out on my days off. I was consuming alcohol and just poor coping strategies, alcohol, drugs, casual sex. And I remember I easily put my gun to my head easily a dozen times. And not because I wanted to commit suicide, but because I wanted to hear that metallic click against my temple, the trigger being pulled. Why I did that, I have no idea, but I did that. And then it also concerns me because how many times did I do that when I was so intoxicated that I don't remember doing that? I remember finding a handwritten contract that I wrote out at about 10 o'clock in the morning that said that from this day forward, I'm not going to consume alcohol anymore. The date was September 28th, 2018 or 19. I don't remember exactly. I don't have it in front of me. But it was like 10:56 in the morning. So I'm thinking I must have really been consuming alcohol last night and realized that enough is enough. You're going to ruin your career. Mm-hmm. You're going to ruin your life. What you've been doing isn't working for you. Mm-hmm. And I think I just overdid it for so many years that I came to the realization that it wasn't working and I really needed help.
It's almost like your higher self. That I'm getting this image of like a stronger part of you. Your higher, and I'm just going to call that your higher self, wrote that contract that I, you know, look, you need to stop consuming alcohol or else you're going to ruin your life. And what are your thoughts on that?
I think you're right. I think there were so many different instances that I realized that I needed help, but I just didn't want to keep reaching out. I didn't want to keep asking for help. I didn't want to be that guy that it always came up, you know, Adam can't be at work because this is going on again. So I tried coping myself, But yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there was something in me that wrote that contract that said, "Hey, right. Adam, you gotta knock it off, or you're gonna ruin everything." And,
yeah.
And you know, one time I remember even texting my mom and dad saying, "I need $50. Please put $50 in my account. I can't tell you why." And they did it, and I didn't realize until the next morning when I'm looking through my text messages that, oh my gosh, I texted my parents. And I don't even remember doing it, but there it was in my cell phone. So it was, there's a lot of different times that I think I slowly began realizing what I was doing to cope wasn't working.
Right.
And so.
So was there anything that, was it that contract that, you know, to not drink anymore? Was that the turning point? What was the turning point for you? And then where did you reach out? And what changed things for you?
I don't think that was the turning point. A lot of people ask me what, how did you stop? How did you say, hey, enough is enough? And I do remember in 2019, I left my department and took a lateral transfer to another agency. And when I went there, I started experiencing the same type of things with depression, with hypervigilance, with being overwhelmed, for forgetfulness, stress that I was feeling at my previous employer. So, you know, in 2019, I was thinking, hey, I'm good to go. I want to start a new path in my life, a new career, find another law enforcement job closer to my family so I can spend more time with my family. And then when I moved down, bought a house, I started experiencing the same thing, the same things just 3.5-4 hours away. So obviously I wasn't any better. I thought I was, but I wasn't. And
right. You took your depression with you.
Right. Right. It doesn't go away. You know, it stays with you if you don't take care of it. And, I remember I resigned 40 days after, and luckily my agency hired me back. And then in 2021, I was a lot healthier, exercising every day, eating healthy, very limited alcohol. And I started experiencing bad dreams, more anxiety, stress like that. And I didn't really understand everything that I was experiencing. So I went to my counselor and I told her, I said, this is what I have going on and I'm concerned. And she said, well, what have you been doing over the last year? And I told her, and she goes, well, that makes sense because you're cutting off alcohol, and it usually takes your body about a year to get back to some kind of normalcy. And now since you're coping positively, you're probably going to start experiencing what you would have experienced after your shooting.
Sure.
But because you cope so poorly, you suppressed it.
Right.
And I'm thinking, that's like 5 years later. And that's one thing that I keep telling myself, that, you know, it's 6-7 years later, I should be better than I am now. But really, I'm not, because I really started addressing my trauma in 2021. Right. So that's something I struggle with, because it's been 6-7 years.
But that's how post-traumatic stress works, right?
Right.
I mean, it'll, the worst of those symptoms will bubble up when you're not, either when your cup overflows or your bucket overflows or your closet is full, whatever analogy you want to use, or, you know, you're not pushing it down anymore with there's many ways of pushing it down. There's drugs, there's working extra shifts, becoming a workaholic. Right. You could become an exercise-aholic and try to, you know, avoid it that way. But then once you cut out your poor coping strategy, which was the drinking, now the PTS comes to the surface. So that makes perfect sense to me.
Right. And my very first nightmare that I knew was directly related to my shooting happened 5 years and 7 months after my shooting.
Uh-huh.
And I have a knife here to kind of explain it. And what it was is I was on duty as a uniformed police officer. I didn't recognize the uniform, but I was in like a medical facility. And there was a guy trying to get into the facility and had a knife similar to this.
Wow.
And he was able to force his way in. And the only way that I was able to stop him from harming me with a knife was to wrap my hands around the blade. And I could feel the tearing, the ripping, the blood, smell the iron.
Wow.
And I asked him, why are you doing this? Stop. Why are you doing this? And he told me, I'm going to kill you because you killed the person that I killed.
Wow.
And then while we were fighting, two other police officers came in and sat down next to us, looked at me, and I'm asking them, help me do something. And one of them said, why should we help you? So I was struggling with that guy with the knife.
Sure.
And then I woke up anxious, sweating, afraid. And
oh,
that
yeah.
was 5 years and 7 months later was my very
yeah.
first dream.
Right. And what do you, I'm just curious what you think, and maybe you've worked this out with your therapist. What do you think the message is in that dream?
I'm really not sure. I mean, I've talked to a lot of different people and I'm really not sure. They think the two police officers that came in and sat down and watched me fight with this person,
uh-huh.
they said maybe those two police officers was this person's two chaperones that were in the store. But I'm really not sure.
Right. Well, my gut sense is that because, you know, you were forced to grab the blade and you're it's hurting yourself. It's punishment for taking the life, but that's you're an inside job. No one else is thinking that you deserve to be punished. You had support all around. Right. But there's probably some guilt that you carry for taking that man's life. And then it comes out in the dream where you end up getting hurt, right? Your hands are being sliced with, as you're trying to stop the assailant.
Right.
So,
and I do, there's a part of me also, this person at the time had a 6-year-old daughter at the time, you know, I have two daughters. So there's a part of me that,
yeah,
it was just a tragic day. Every single day I think about it one way or another, and it's,
sure,
you know,
right.
Shooting somebody and taking somebody's life isn't something I take lightly.
Right.
It was just a really horrible day.
Yes. Yes. Right. But you were following protocol and it needed to be done because what if with that, what did he have? You said he had an axe or a...
Yeah, a hatchet.
A hatchet. He could have hurt so many people in that Walmart.
Yeah, it was on a Friday, 5:15 in the afternoon. So it was
a very busy
store.
Yeah.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a national alliance of first responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
What did you find the most helpful in terms of working through some of these challenges you were having? What mental health tools were the most effective?
First thing was getting off the poor coping strategies, the alcohol, the casual sex, the binge eating, but going to counseling. I remember the first time I went to counseling, I remember speaking and venting for 45 minutes. And it felt good. It really was helpful. And then I remember leaving thinking, why am I wasting my time? This person has no idea what I'm going through. Why am I wasting my time sitting there talking to this person?
Was this a therapist who works with first responders?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was just, you know, so I would go for, you know, a month and two and then take 3 months off. And then I'd get a letter saying, you need to get back here. We're concerned about you, stuff like that. And then I'd go back and. Overall, it was helpful. It was really, really helpful. I remember going to EMDR. That was a huge breakthrough for me. For many years, so throughout my law enforcement career, I always prided myself without having to use force. And, you know, I used my taser a couple times. I never pepper sprayed anybody. But what I didn't know I was doing was I was comparing my shooting to all these other incidents I was involved in, and they're completely different. So for whatever reason, I kept thinking, I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. That's why I had to use deadly force. I'm not good enough. But with EMDR, they said, think about the worst part of the shooting and compare it with I'm not good enough. And I thought, that doesn't make any sense. If I wasn't good enough, I wouldn't have been able to do my job.
Of course.
And that that was a huge, huge breakthrough for me and helped me heal and connect dots and answer questions that I've had over the years. So I'm a strong supporter of EMDR. It worked for me.
Fantastic. Let's shift gears and talk a little bit about what you're up to now and your mission, Stop the Threat, Stop the Stigma. What, when you say threat, what is that referring to?
I think what it's referring to is the threat of being happy, having a good life, having a healthy mental health, being able to progress in your life and be successful. If you don't address your mental health challenges, you're just going to keep, you know, going downhill. Mm-hmm. And like I did for many years, I was just suffering in silence and coping the way I thought would help. And it really didn't. It just made it just made things worse. It added stress. It added anxiety. I founded Stop the Threat, Stop the Stigma in 2021 in hopes that by me sharing my experience, it'll inspire other law enforcement professionals and those who work in the public safety profession, pretty much anybody, regardless of what profession you're in, to speak about their mental health, to reach out if they need that, to be there for somebody if they are struggling and they feel alone and they feel like they don't have anybody. It's so easy nowadays to send a text message or to even face-to-face, hey, how you doing? I care about you. If you need something, let me know. I know that's awkward sometimes. It's uncomfortable for some people, but it's so important. With my experience, I could have been in a room with 100 people of family and friends, and I would feel alone. So it's so crucial to let somebody know that you're struggling or to be there for somebody if they're struggling. And I know that's not an easy thing. And I believe that first responders and probably anybody, if they don't feel confident in their leadership or supervisors, if they come out and say, I'm struggling, I need some help, if they don't feel confident that things are going to be okay,
right?
If they feel that they're going to be criticized or they may lose their job, they're not going to reach out. They're going to continue to suffer in silence, self-destructive behavior, maybe self-harm, suicide.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something that's really important.
So what have you observed as the response to your program?
I've spoken with many people across the globe, in the United States, in Canada, in the UK, and it's pretty much the same. There's so many people, first responders, who are suffering in silence, who struggle with mental health, and a lot of it is the stigma. They don't want to reach out because they're worried that everything they've worked so hard for, 10, 15, 20, 30 years, they're going to lose it if they say, hey, I need help because I'm suffering. They think they're going to be judged. They think they're going to lose their job. So that's why I established Stop the Threat, Stop the Stigma. That's why I'm very transparent about my experience.
Right. Yeah.
And I want to share what I went through because I know I can't be the only one that goes through what I've gone through and what I continue to struggle with.
There's some of your the pictures on your website, social media, very powerful. Law enforcement officer wearing a ballistic vest that says, I see a therapist, I take medications, it's okay to talk about mental health. That's pretty bold.
Powerful, yeah.
It's the reality, though. It's the reality. It's something that first responders just don't talk about. Here's my pills right here. I'm on medicine right now. I take Lexapro. And it works for me. It works great. And I just want to put it out there that it's okay to talk about your mental health. It really is.
And there's you could still be tough, you know, because the paradox is like it's on the back of the ballistic vest, like, you know, advertising that, you know, I'm a police officer. I have the duty to protect and I have a dangerous job. That's why I'm wearing this ballistic vest. Right. But that at the same time, not being afraid to put it out there that you struggle with mental health.
Right. You know, take the vest off, take it off and get the kind of help you need. Take care of yourself so you can continue in your career and be healthy and be successful and reach out to other people and protect your community. I designed those tactical Velcro patches, and I have many different ones. I have them for fire departments and corrections and sheriff's deputies and you name it. And it's the reality. We just don't talk about it, and we need to talk about it. It's that stigma. You know, even now there are some things that I struggle with, and my first reaction is I can't tell my supervisor that because I'm a new employee, and what if I get judged? What if my colleagues judge me? But then I'm thinking, no, Adam, you have to. It's okay to talk about your mental health. That stigma has to stop.
Yeah.
So many first responders are committing suicide. So many first responders struggle, and they
getting divorced.
They need to know it's okay to talk about your mental health.
Right. And it has to come from first responders first and foremost. I think, you know, us therapists can be out there, and I am out there trying to educate, but I think that it's so much more powerful and poignant when it comes from a first responder saying, I struggle with depression or post-traumatic stress, and I went to get help, and I'm better because of that.
I agree. And it's not easy, and it's uncomfortable.
It's not easy. No.
You know, and unfortunately, you may be judged, and unfortunately, you may lose your job. But your health and your safety is so much more important.
But at least there's legislation now. Like, and I don't know what it's like where in your part of the country, but in Connecticut, there's legislation against that, where if you do go for rehab, or you know, if you're in therapy, that you cannot be demoted, or you know, or passed over for promotion, or you know, fired, because you know you have the right to take care of your mental health needs.
Right, right. Well, what happened with me is in December 28th, 2021, I was at an active shooter training. And we were watching a PowerPoint presentation, and we were discussing the different active shooters over the year. Mm. And we came to a point where they kept saying, April, that was when my shooting occurred. And I had a panic attack. I was sitting comfortably in a chair. I felt like I was about to pass out. I got really hot. Yeah. I went to wipe my brow, and there was so much water in my hand. And there was probably about 20 other law enforcement professionals there, and everybody knew me. If I would have just reached out and said, I'm having a panic attack, I can't do this training, I need help, it would have been okay. But my first response was, I can't. I can't say nothing. I got to try to fight through this. And I did. So I did that and continued through the training, went on my days off. On December 31st, I went into work to work a patrol shift, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I reached out to one of my supervisors, and I said, I want to quit. And we spoke with the chief, and I was sent home. And I don't think I wanted to quit my job. I think I was just fed up. I needed the right kind of therapy.
Yeah.
So what happened was, is I went to our psychologist, and after seven hours, I was unfit for duty. I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder, PTSD, dissociative disorder. And then I requested to go on a 90-day leave of absence, and that was approved through our contract. So after that 90-day leave of absence, I was requested to meet with the chief, and I was told that I could either resign or they were going to terminate me. They were not going to extend my leave of absence. And I said, I am not going to quit. I chose not to quit, and then they terminated me. So that was, I'm still at a loss because all my life, all I've ever wanted to be was a police officer, as far back as I can remember. Yeah. And then all of a sudden I get walked out of the police department and it's kind of like, that's it. And, you know, I go home and at the time I was engaged. So I had somebody to go home to. But what if I didn't? What if I would have went home and killed myself because my lifelong career just ended? Nobody checked up on me. I just went home. What if I would have said, forget it, I'm done.
Uh-huh.
And that would have been it. I just felt abandoned. I felt kind of,
you betrayed.
You don't work here anymore. And then I leave and that was it.
That's institutional abandonment.
Right.
Wow.
Well, so wonderful that you've put all that into being of service to first responders, especially law enforcement professionals, with your Stop the Threats, Stop the Stigma mission. I think, hopefully that's going to be fulfilling to see that you're making a positive change out there.
I think so. There was a therapist that reached out a couple months ago and said that I had an officer come to my office today and he is going to seek treatment after he heard you speak. So that, that meant everything to me. That's what it's all about right there. If I can share my experience and help just one person or help one person help somebody else, that's what it's all about.
Mm. Absolutely. How can people find you out there on social media or internet?
Well, you can visit StopTheThreatStopTheStigma.org, or you can email me, Adam@StopTheThreatStopTheStigma.org.
Fantastic. Adam, words cannot express how moved I feel listening to you so courageously and honestly share your story and everything you've been through, and the fact that you're using that to pay it forward in a positive way is super inspiring. So thank you so much for being here and sharing your story with us.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I really appreciate it. It means a lot to me.
Yeah, I think it takes so much courage for you to, exactly what David said, you know, to share your personal story, really to help other first responders that are struggling. And there are many of them out there. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Please like and subscribe, YouTube, Responder Resilience Channel. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and we are respondertv.com is our website. Check out our past episodes on the website. Until the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.